So tonight, yeah, it is a bit more measured, and it's less of a sermon, more of kind of, I guess, a paper discussion type thing tonight, which I think is appropriate given the topic. So I don't have kind of a flashy illustration to start everything off tonight. Not that my illustrations are that good usually or anything. But tonight, so we're talking about the question, how can God be good if he judges people and sends them to hell? Which sounds intense just when you say that, right? And I think in order to approach this topic, we need two tools tonight. Two tools in order to tackle this topic. The first tool we need is care. The worst thing that we could possibly ever do, particularly as Christians, is to talk about this topic flippantly or to treat it purely as some sort of head knowledge theological argument, because this is a topic that is talking about real people, and many of us know real people, and we are all affected by this. So we need great care and sensitivity when we talk about this. It's not a matter of you're going to hell, you're going to heaven, and just talking about it, you know, with throwaway lines like that. This is a serious, serious topic. This is people's eternity we're talking about. So we need great care. The second tool we need is humility. All of us can come to this particular topic with our preconceived ideas. Like we're coming with our own goggles on through which we view this topic about God's justice. Okay? So we need humility, and we need the humility to ask this question. Could it be that the author of the universe's view of justice and understanding of justice is more developed than your own? That's a good question to ask. Could it be that the author of the universe's view of love and mercy could perhaps be more developed than your own view of love and mercy? It takes humility to ask that question. It says in Isaiah 55, God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than yours, and my thoughts are higher than your thoughts." So when you look throughout the Bible, and even just in life, God always seems to be doing things that that I would never do. So like appearing to Moses in a burning bush. If I was in God's shoes, I would never have chosen to do that. It's just so unpredictable. It's just so far out there, right? And there are so many things. And I would never, if I was God, choose to come as a baby in a manger. Like that surprised everybody. So God's ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And we need humility to know that. But this is the thing. We need to keep that intention with the fact that we have all been designed with a God-given sense of justice within us. And that's because I believe we've been made in the image of a God who is of justice and knows wrong from right. So that's our moral compass, right? I hear people talking about everybody has a moral compass, like the ability to discern wrong from right. But the thing about that is, our moral compasses, because we live in a broken world, can become rusted and even broken. So it's important to ask questions and to follow our intuition about what we feel is wrong and right, but sometimes that can't be 100% accurate. And we need the humility to believe that too. Does that make sense? So when we're approaching this, we need those two things, care and humility. So we're going to jump in. How can God be good and there be a judgment? So throughout the Bible, God makes it really, really clear that he, as the architect of the universe, as the author of everything, he is driving humanity, all of history, all of time, towards a conclusion, towards a definite end. It's like he's been weaving this beautifully complex tapestry from the beginning of time, and it's all going to be beautifully revealed at the end. And he has invited each one of us who have been created, that's all of us, to be involved and to participate in this unfolding story that he's got humanity on. And it's going somewhere. It's got a definite end. This is why you and I exist. This is God's will for us to be involved in his unfolding plan for the world. And this is where it all ends up. The end of Revelation says, this is John saying this, he says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people and he will dwell with them. They will be his people and God himself will be with them and be their God. So it's a beautiful picture of the end of all things, the new heavens and the new earth. And what's that describing? That what that is describing is a eternal community, this perfect community that God himself is intricately and intimately a part of forever. And God's desire for each one of us is to end up there, is to be part of that perfect eternal community with God. That's what he wants for each one of us. But in order for everything to get there, creation itself has to undergo a transformation, right? Like a caterpillar going into a cocoon and going through that transformation, becoming a butterfly. All of creation needs to go through this transition in order to be prepared for the age to come. And part of that transition is the final judgment. Judgment, just the word judgment, has negative connotations for us, right? Hence the picture. Even Crunch Gym down the road, you know what the slogan is? No judgment. Yeah, although I'm pretty sure people are judging you when you're there. But anyway. But judgment, the connotations are, you know, excluding people, judging a book by its cover, and of course those things are bad, but judgment doesn't need to have negative connotations straight away if it's properly understood. A scholar called N.T. Wright, you might be familiar with him, he reminds us that God's judgment is actually a good thing. So he says, we need to remind ourselves that throughout the Bible, not least in the Psalms, God's coming judgment is a good thing, something to be celebrated, longed for, yearned over. In a world of systemic injustice, bullying, violence, arrogance, and oppression, the thought that there might come a day when the wicked are firmly put in their place and the poor and weak are given their due is the best news there can be. Faced with a world in rebellion, a world full of exploitation and wickedness, a good God must be a God of judgment. So you get what he's saying there. He's saying, if you look at the world, if you look at the presence of evil, a good God must not be silent when it comes to those things. He must hold those things to account in order for God to be truly good. If he was just silent and indifferent to it, he would not be good. So N.T. Wright is saying, our question tonight is, how can God be good and there be a judgment? But he's saying, you should flip that question. It should be, how can God be good and there not be a judgment? To kind of illustrate this, in Rwanda, I was leading a conference for pastors there, and I was doing some teachings on God's justice. And one pastor came up to me afterwards, because it was a bit hard with the interpretation. I was speaking English. They didn't speak English. And he asked me what I meant by God's justice, and I said, that is God putting wrong things right. That's what I meant by that, God putting wrong things right. And like we heard a little bit about tonight, if you know the history of Rwanda, man, there is a craving for ultimate justice. Because in 1994, the fastest genocide in the history of humanity took place, where 1 million people, a minority group, 1 million people were killed in 100 days. So the rate of murder is just unbelievable for that to have happened. And you talk to people who have survived that, who lived through the most traumatic things you could ever imagine. And you hear those stories and you hear their frustration, the deep hurt as they express it to you. It's traumatic. Now, how can God be good and leave that kind of mass atrocity and evil unanswered? Just unanswered forever. The final judgment is God's answer to horrors like that. That is God holding the perpetrators to account. That is Him answering that. And that is something that should be longed for. Does that make sense? So the final judgment is the necessary transformation of all creation and us into the eternal community that God's always desired for us to be a part of, into the new heavens and the new earth. But these are kind of all the big general broad stroke questions about what the judgment means and what it signifies. But what about you and me here tonight? What does the judgment mean for you and me? This is where we really need care and humility. So first of all, we need to just do a hypothetical. We need to ask ourselves the question, what if at the end of it all, you take your final breath, you open your eyes, there is no judgment. There's no judgment at all. There's nothing. One amazing playwright from the 20th century was a guy called Arthur Miller, and he wrote a play called After the Fall. And in that play, he pretty much unpacks and expounds on that question. What if there is no final judgment? And he's writing here, I'm going to do read a quote from it. He's writing in a character whose name is Quentin. He's expressing his thoughts. Just listen to this. For many years, I looked at life like a case at law. It was a series of proofs. When you're young, you prove how brave you are, how smart you are. Then, as you get older, you prove what a good lover you are, then a good father. Finally, how wise or powerful or whatever. But underlying it all, I see now there was a presumption that I was moving on some sort of upward path towards some elevation where God knows that I would be justified or even condemned. A verdict, anyway. I'd get a verdict. I think now that my disaster really began when I looked up one day and the bench was empty. No judge in sight. And all that remained was the endless argument with myself, this pointless litigation of existence before an empty bench, which of course is another way of saying despair. So for whatever reason, this character in this play thought that at the end of it all, there was no judge on the bench. He'd been living his whole life with this presumption that he would get a verdict over his life from some sort of higher power, that everything in his life choices would either be affirmed, his good choices would be affirmed and his bad choices would be condemned, but just a verdict. He just automatically lived his life with that presumption. But at the end, he came to the conclusion that there was no judge. So was he happy about that? No. It brought despair, absolute despair, at the pointlessness of everything he'd ever done. And it will do the same thing for us. If there is no judge, that means that there is no accountability for the morals or ethics in the universe. There's no ultimate accountability. Nothing, nobody and nothing will be held to account. So the whole genocide in Rwanda and thousands of other incidences like that are just meaningless. Nothing. Nothing. Good doesn't triumph. Evil doesn't triumph. It's just nothing. It's just random. And that is a serious thing. And it also means if there's no ultimate judge at the end of it all to give a verdict to humanity and to each of us, that means it's up to us to decide what's morally right, what's morally wrong, what's ethical and what's not ethical. And that's a mess. That's a mess. There's no like solid truth in anything. It's just plastic and malleable. And it's anarchy. Everyone may as well do whatever they want, pretty much. So you need to ask yourself that question. If there is no one on the bench, what does that mean for you now? What does it mean for you in your life and your life choices? Then you need to ask the other question. What if there is someone on the bench? And that someone happens to be the person, the being that has the power and authority to be the one to delight in you for all of eternity. To be the one who wants to pour wonder on your head forevermore. To get you into a perfect community of belonging and love and reconciliation and wholeness and beauty and amazement forevermore. What if that person is on the bench? Do you want to ignore that? Do you want to live your life ignoring that? And what if there is a consequence for choosing to live your life in ignorance of this person, this being? Do you want to ignore that? You with me? Because according to the Bible, the entirety of Scripture is 100% certain and unified in the certainty of the final judgment. Absolutely. All from the Old Testament straight through to the New Testament. 2 Corinthians 5:10 says, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each of us may receive what is due for us, the things done while in the body, whether good or bad." Hebrews says, "Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of him to whom we must give account." Now, if you read that verse, this is what I was thinking in the week. If you read that verse, the Hebrews verse, and go, "Oh, everything uncovered and laid bare before God. Ah, I don't feel comfortable with that. That's intense." Then what I reckon that feeling is, that you're feeling, is your inbuilt, the way that God has designed you to sense and discern your own guilt over your sin. That's the reaction that you're feeling. Because we all know that we're sinful deep down and falling short of God's standards. And who will be on the bench? Can you tell me? Who will be the judge? Jesus, yes, Jesus, that's it. Jesus will be the judge. And think about who Jesus is, okay? This is the one who's going to be on the seat, the judge of the living and the dead. Think about who he is. He is the one who was God, who came to earth to absolutely love humanity, to show us all what it really means to be human, to live out our potential as humans the way God designed us to. He is the one who performed the highest act of love possible for you and me by giving his life, the life of God, for your life. Absolute sacrificial love. That's who Jesus is. And he did that so that you can get a pardon through the final judgment. Right? That's Jesus. And he is the one who will be judging. He says in John, the Father has given him authority to judge because he's the Son of Man. Because he's the point of it all, right? He's the center of God's tapestry, of history. He's what it's all about. He's the greatest revelation of God. Jesus is the greatest revelation of God. And he holds the keys to your pardon. But what if you reject all of this? What if you just reject it? That there's a necessary dark side to the judgment. But the question is, does this make God bad or is he still good? We talked about this a little bit last week. So God's plan as the author of the universe was to weave this tapestry, to create a beautiful, complex story, to get it to a conclusion. But part of all of that meant a great risk for God, because he wanted us to love him. He wants us to choose him and to want to be in this relationship with him. But in order to truly love him, we need the ability to choose. Forced love is not real love, right? You can't force somebody into a relationship with another person and expect that to be true love. Real love means a choice. It's a giving over of your trust completely to the other person voluntarily. So God, in his design of us, he didn't create us as robots or some weird zombies just doing the will of their master. We're not puppets on a string. He designed us with free will. And the ultimate decision, according to the Bible, that we'll ever make in our lives is either to choose him, to accept him, to love him, or to not. And because God's greatest demonstration of love is him coming to earth as Jesus and giving his life for us, that means that this decision lies specifically in whether or not we choose to accept Jesus. Because Jesus is the ultimate, the universal standard for judgment for every human being on the planet. Does that make sense? Everybody will be judged based on whether they have had a relationship with Jesus and recognize him as Lord. And remember, Jesus is the one judging that. So he's the best person to judge it, right? He'll either say, I know you. I know you. Or he'll say, I never knew you. That's what it'll come down to. Because we love to write our own story. We love to, our inclination as humans is to reject God's story and write our own. But because of that, God, in his protection of the preciousness of his love, must in his very nature, in that protection, bring justice. Because God's love is so precious and his grace so abundantly free. Free. It cost us nothing for Jesus to come and to give us this pardon and to have a relationship with God. But it cost God everything. It cost him everything. Jesus reached down to us to pull us out of our mess. And it cost him everything. It cost him his life. It cost us nothing. So there has to be a consequence for not choosing him. Does that make sense? If there was no consequence, then God's love would be cheapened if it didn't matter in the end whether we chose him or recognized Jesus or not. His love would be cheapened. It's like if my wife cheated on me and I was just indifferent to it. I was just like, yeah, whatever. Do you think there would be a problem with my love for her if that happened? Because part of love, true love, is protection. It's there's jealousy, like good jealousy involved in perfect love. So if God didn't care if we chose whatever else, then his love wouldn't be true. It would be cheapened. And so there's a consequence for not choosing him, and that consequence is what we call hell. I know we're kind of pushed for time, so I'm going to smash through this. First of all, there are many different myths about hell, right? And it's important to kind of debunk these, especially the pop culture myths about hell. So if you've watched the show The Good Place, I don't know if you've seen that on Netflix, or there's so many different shows out there that are kind of propagating these myths about hell. So hell is not a party for the devil and his demons to enjoy for all eternity torturing the lost. I mean, the devil, according to scripture, the devil and his demons are the first ones to be thrown into hell. It's not a party for the lost to kind of revel in their badness for all of eternity. It's not that either. It can't be geographically located. The idea that heaven is up there and hell is down below us is also a myth. That was kind of created in the medieval times, that myth that we all get taken into the pearly gates, into the clouds with the unicorns and the harp playing angels. And that if you get a guilty verdict, you're escorted by the demons down the staircase into the fire and all of that. So that was kind of, that imagery was propagated in the medieval times. Because what we're talking about is something very foreign to our human ability to understand. There's almost no category for it. Because at this point, we're talking about a time when time itself and space has ended, right? So it's beyond that. It's beyond that realm. And so all we have is metaphor to describe hell and to get meaning from hell. Jesus used metaphors. He talked about hell as Gehenna in Matthew 5. Gehenna was a literal place just outside of the gates of Jerusalem where they burned rubbish and buried dead people. So it had a history of being a cursed place. So Jesus is using that real place as a metaphor that for hell being a cursed place. The lake of fire at the end of Revelation as well, if you're familiar with that, that's a continuation of the metaphor that Jesus used for hell. But you've got to be really careful in interpreting those images in the Bible literally. You've got to be careful there because all we have is metaphor, metaphor upon metaphor. So you've got to be cautious with that. I don't think there's any way we can ever possibly have a physical recognition of what hell is. But we can get meaning from these metaphors. And some of the descriptions in Scripture that we see is hell is a place where you come to grips eternally with your failure to accept God's love. Hell is a place where you are eternally isolated from God and community. And that is a big thing. And God is the big thing there. Eternally isolated from God and His presence. And God's presence, we take for granted, but God's presence bring anything that is good and beautiful and true and hopeful in life. So if you remove God's presence, then what do you have? Nothing good. And because of this isolation, because you're alone and you're coming to grips with your failure to accept God's love forever, you're eternally despairing. C.S. Lewis also has another take on hell, which like people like Tim Keller kind of talk about as well. It's this idea that the doors of hell are locked from the inside, which means that we are all kind of, we've got this selfishness in us, right? But God is always intervening and stopping us from being completely selfish beyond repair. But C.S. Lewis says that hell could potentially be a place where God stops intervening and He leaves us to our own selfishness for all of eternity, which means that we corrode from the inside out. We just think of ourselves and only ourselves and all the yuck because God's removed His presence, so there's nothing good there. It's just selfishness. And God just says, have it your way. You want selfishness, have it your way. And we're so selfish that we have no ability to hope, therefore no ability to hope to even leave where we are, therefore no ability to leave. So that's the dark side of the judgment. And it is horrific when you think about it. And like I said, you don't want to be flippant about this because this involves real people. But does it make God bad or vindictive or reckless? I would say no. Because remember, with humility, He knows the right consequence for an outright rejection of Him. His justice as the author of the universe must be perfect. And He knows things that we don't know. He knows secrets that we hide. And it says that all secrets will be revealed. And God is the best person to make a judgment about that. And He has also literally crossed the face of heaven and earth to pour himself out completely for us in absolute love so that we don't ever have to face hell. He's already done that. And so the choice is up to us. And there's a final quote at the end here. C.S. Lewis again, he says in an essay he wrote called The Weight of Glory, he says, in the end, that face which is the delight or the terror of the universe must be turned upon each of us, either with one expression or with the other, either conferring glory inexpressible or inflicting shame that can never be cured or disguised. So in the end, God as the judge will either be the one of the creator of the universe who wants to bestow delight on us as his children. That is an amazing and beautiful thing. But there's always a flip side to that. So I know that was a lot to take in, a lot of information. So we're just going to take a few moments now. Andrew's got some discussion sheets with just some questions like we've been doing the last couple of weeks. So just take a few moments to look at some of those questions, and then because of time, we might choose a few of those to go through.